Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. Do libertarians have a problem with the law? Well, yes and no. They want less laws on the books, and they certainly want to tweak and change a whole bunch of others, but they generally don't have a problem with rule of law, which can ensure liberty if it's properly applied, and therefore the libertarian community can occasionally produce a great lawyer or a great law professor or legal scholar or all of those things. And that's the case with our guest, Randy Barnett, graduate of Harvard Law School, a man who teaches law, constitutional law, at Georgetown University, and who's been nicknamed, in fun, I think, by his colleagues as Mr. Ninth Amendment, because he invokes it often. Not many people do. Here's Randy Barnett. Randy Barnett, like the gunslingers of old, you have a moniker, a nickname that probably strikes fear in your judicial opponents when they hear it, and it's Mr. Ninth Amendment. And so when they're told Mr. Ninth Amendment is in town, boy, they run for cover. And so how did you get that name?
Well, because I once gave a speech in which the Ninth Amendment proved to be the punchline of the speech, but I knew that at the time I did this that really no one knew much about the Ninth Amendment. In fact, the Ninth Amendment was the punchline of a joke, and the joke is, what are you going to argue, the Ninth Amendment? Meaning you have no argument. So I actually decided maybe I should learn something about it, and I had a research assistant go off and get a pile of everything that had ever been written about the Ninth Amendment. It turns out it was a set of photocopies. It was about that thick. And I realized if I just read everything in that pile, that would make me the world's leading authority on the Ninth Amendment.
So I did. In one day, in one afternoon.
And I became Mr. Ninth Amendment after that.
And that's the amendment. I'm going to look smart here, but that's only because I'm reading about you and I'm reading the amendment. That's the amendment that reserves to the people any rights not specifically granted by the Constitution.
Right. It says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So it's a mention. It specifically says that the rights in the Constitution are not the only rights we have.
And you contend, and I think this is how you phrase it, that that amendment has been, quote, written out of law, unquote, meaning it is so unused, unread, uncommented, that really basically it ceases to exist. And I would have thought, given the armies of lawyers and judges commenting on all of this over the decades and centuries, that in fact every amendment would have its Bible of commentary and so on. But that's not the case. How did that happen?
Well, it turns out, and one of the reasons why I became a contracts professor after being a criminal prosecutor and not a constitutional law professor is because when I was in law school, every time we got to one of the good parts of the Constitution that protected liberty and limited government power, we would turn the page of the casebook and we would discover how the Supreme Court had essentially interpreted it out of existence. And so after seeing one provision after the other, including the Ninth Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, and various other provisions, I decided that, look, if the Supreme Court's not going to take the Constitution seriously, then why should I? And I became a contracts professor where writings are still taken seriously. But then I somehow got sucked back into talking about the Constitution anyway.
And given the fact that liberty is your dominant value, it's where all your work, it's what all your work points to, it's the direction you're working in, and you cherish that cause, when somebody realizes that and then reads the amendment in that light, you can immediately see the huge influence it could have if it were invoked more often, but it's not. And so I'm wondering, you're all alone pushing this stone up the hill. Are you getting somewhere with it?
I think so. I have a new book coming out called Our Republican Constitution, in which I argue that we actually don't have a Democratic government. We have a Republican government. And what makes a Republican government Republican is that it protects the rights of we the people, each and every one of us, not we the people as a group. Mm-hmm. So the way it protects the rights of we the people, each and every one of us, shows that it's the rights of we the people, the ones to which the Ninth Amendment refers, that makes a republic a republic. And then the question then is whether the institutions created by the Constitution are effective at protecting the rights of each and every one of us.
Yet I have the feeling that you're cognizant of the odds being stacked against you because you've said, jokingly, well, I argued once before the Supreme Court and it'll never happen again. It may never happen again. It probably never happen again, but I don't care. So you sort of turned your back on them the way they turned their back on you because cases based on that kind of law are not expected to get very high up the ladder.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I had a I don't have a bucket list. If I had one, I suppose arguing in the Supreme Court would have been on my bucket list. Also, being in a feature film would have been on my bucket list, and I got to do both of those things. I don't need to do any one of those things a second time. It's a tremendous amount of pressure and work. And when the healthcare case, the challenge to Obamacare, went to the Supreme Court, I was perfectly happy. Not for a moment did I want to be the person up there arguing that case. So I was perfectly happy to let the people who do that for a living do it all the time, do it for this case as well.
And you weren't unhappy with the numbers either, because when you finally did go to the Supremes, you lost 6-3, which was a heck of a lot better than what they had predicted, which was 8-1.
Right. In the Raich case, which is the medical marijuana case that you're talking about, the one I did argue, we did lose 6-3. We got Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Thomas, and Justice O'Connor's vote on behalf of my client Angel Raich and Diane Monson, who both wanted to use marijuana for medical purposes as authorized by state law. We said it was beyond the power of Congress to stop them from doing that, and we lost 6-3 on that subject. But it was because of the knowledge that I gained as a result of that case about the Commerce Clause that I was in a position to come up with a legal theory as to why the individual insurance mandate in Obamacare was also unconstitutional, which was a Commerce Clause challenge as well. That one, we actually won on the law, 5-4. We had five justices who said we were right about the limits of Commerce Clause and the limits of the Necessary and Proper Clause that goes along with it. And the reason why we ultimately didn't defeat Obamacare is because Chief Justice Roberts decided to change the law so that it was no longer a mandate that would be unconstitutional, into an option to buy insurance or not, or pay a small fine, or which he called a tax, and that's how they upheld the law, even though conceding that we were right on the Constitution. So we'd actually gone from 6-3 against us to 5-4 in favor.
Congratulations. And
would have been nicer if we'd have actually defeated Obamacare.
And this is the case where you argued something very interesting and original, I thought anyway, where you said that the government could not regulate inactivity. In other words, if you didn't want a health contract and you wanted out of all that, the law couldn't force you into it. And I thought to myself, yes, but for instance, the law does force you to get a driver's license. There's all kinds of things like that. So am I confusing them or?
No, it's a standard question that we got during the case. But basically, if you want to drive, the law tells you how you have to do it. The law tells you that all the time. If you want to build a building, if you want to drive a car, there's all kinds of ways in which if you want to do something, you have to do it a certain way. That's called a regulation. It's making your conduct regular. But in what had not happened was to actually make you. It would be like saying, you must drive a car.
Yeah, of course.
We're going to force you to drive a car, and then you have to get a license. After we make you buy a car, then we'll make you get a license. Okay. Well, in the medical marijuana case, what the court upheld was the prohibition stopping Angel Raich and Diane Monson from using the marijuana they'd grown, for growing it and using it. They were going to stop them. But in the Raich case, they didn't make them grow marijuana and make them use it. And in the individual insurance mandate, they were going to make you do business with a private company. Well, the Supreme Court, 5-4, agreed that that's beyond the power of Congress to do.
And will Obamacare survive all these challenges?
Well, it has so far. But one of the one things that I thought we succeeded in doing with Obamacare is we deprived it of what you might call legitimacy for a period of years. It was sort of in a gray zone, in a twilight zone of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And it has never really fully attained legitimacy, which is the reason why in the next election, I believe, it's going to be one of the issues that that election will turn on. And what happens with Obamacare in the future will be dictated by what happens in the next election.
Now, leaving legal issues aside for a moment, when Obamacare came out and there were all those problems with the computers and the whole thing was a terrible mess, you in your living room sitting there watching all this, everybody had egg on their face, did you have a bit of schadenfreude saying, I knew this was no good?
Yeah. For 2 years, I argued what an abysmal public policy Obamacare would be. And if we'd won, then all we would have heard from then until now is how wonderful it would have been if the court had only let us do it. So I guess one of the upsides of having lost the case in that sense is that now the American people have gotten to see just how terrible Obamacare was, as we said it would be for the 2 years we litigated the case.
And libertarianism and the law, that's a very intriguing combination, because laws, when we think of laws, they're there to regulate, to forbid, to punish, to reward, but they're certainly there to make sure we act a certain way. Libertarianism goes in the other direction, and therefore less law is always better law. But does that put you in a kind of a legal ghetto with a small group? I mean, Ron Paul for years said a bunch of things that's kind of seeped into the political discourse, but we've even forgotten that they started with him, that he was the first to popularize them. Are libertarian lawyers on the fringes trying to get into the mainstream?
This certainly was the case when I became a law professor, you know, many years ago. It's less so today. There aren't that many of us. We're still a very, very small number of compared to the number of law professors that are there. But we do speak pretty effectively, and we have had influence. In fact, you might say there is a conservative legal movement that mm-hmm. libertarians are a part of, and libertarians are having a big impact in that movement. We used to be marginal even in the conservative legal movement, and now we're becoming rather central. And what's distinctive about our approach is that we say that judges should be responsible for protecting the liberties of the people. Judges are agents of the people, and they are responsible to protect the liberties of the people from being violated by legislatures, whereas conservatives for a very long time believed in what they call judicial restraint, mm-hmm. where judges should back off and let the legislature do its will. They should defer to the legislature, and we've been resisting that. And now that resistance to that idea is starting to catch on, and we've even seen presidential candidates who argue that judges must be vigilant and engaged to ensure that legislators have not exceeded their proper powers.
And in every Western democracy, whether it's the U.S. or Canada or in Europe or wherever, we see that there's a movement, even outside of libertarianism, even non-libertarian politicians and civil servants want less bureaucracy, less regulation, less red tape. Everybody agrees on that. They want less of it. But it just keeps growing back. You get rid of a ton of it, and all of a sudden another ton appears on your doorstep. Is it a bit thankless?
Well, look, you can't. It's a big problem. It's been going on for a long time. It's a result of a major, powerful intellectual movement, the progressive movement, which had a 100-year head of steam in increasing regulation. The idea is government must do something. You know, you have to do something. It doesn't really mm-hmm. matter what the something is. You've got to do something. So government must do something to solve social problems, or now to achieve what's called social justice. And so they have a very, very powerful influence. And the classical liberals, the libertarians, the conservatives who are classical liberals who believe that government is there to protect our liberty and to protect our rights and not to do much more than that, we've had an uphill fight for a very long time. So, yes, it's going to be difficult to roll it all back. But the problem with the major progressive movement of taking over our lives is it doesn't really work very well. It's just one catastrophe after another, and hopefully eventually everybody will understand what the causes of these catastrophes are, rather than when the government creates one catastrophe, then the government is offered as the solution to it. And I think with the rise of the internet and alternate media, we've been much more effective in pointing this out than we ever used to be when there was a monopoly on the explanation for why we were facing one catastrophe after the other.
Isn't it going to require, though, a cultural revolution, a real one, among politicians as a group, irrespective of their parties, aside from the population, because it is ingrained, it's in their DNA to do something, as you say. And it's very hard to imagine politicians saying, oh, let's do nothing. As a matter of fact, if a politician dared to think of that, his advisors would immediately say, don't say something so foolish, you'll be laughed out of town. So it requires a cultural revolution.
Well, it's a political revolution, I agree. But there, you know, if we have a competing party system, maybe one of the two parties is more likely to take on that view. And I think, for example, in the United States, in the Republican Party, there is a fight within the party. Mm-hmm. Not everybody in the party takes this view, but there is a fight within the party between sometimes what's called the Tea Party folks, but that's sort of just a loose name, who believe in limited government, and the sort of big government conservatives that have, in fact, been in power before, and we'll have to see what the outcome of that struggle is. But there is traction now for a small government, limited government, constitutional government, mm-hmm. Limited by the constitutional. The phrase constitutional conservative has valence now that didn't before, meaning limited government, according to the rules of the Constitution. This is a political movement that, and it's a grassroots movement that did not exist when I started being a professor, when it was just a number of intellectuals in a room or professors talking to each other or libertarians in groups talking to each other. There is now a grassroots movement in the United States for something like this. We don't know if it'll prevail, but the first thing you need is to have people be interested, and we do have that now.
And one thing I find fascinating, looking at it from a Canadian perspective, looking at the Republican debates and so on, is that one thing that seems to be holding back any libertarian progress or progress in the libertarian agenda is that the clientele that should normally go for that is also the same clientele that wants a vigorous national defense and a big standing army and lots of action going on, things that cost money and create big government. And for one Ron Paul or Rand Paul, both of them, who say, let's get out of there, we shouldn't go to these places, these are foreign wars, we have no business in there. For that small group, there is a far larger majority of right-wingers who may want less regulation, smaller government, but they want the big standing army, and there's a contradiction there.
Well, look, if you're going to have a government, the government's job is to protect our rights domestically from criminals and from people who would violate our rights, but also internationally. So there isn't necessarily a contradiction between a libertarian worldview and having a strong national defense. I know that Ron Paul says he believes in a strong national defense, and I believe that Rand Paul also says, and he believes, that we need a strong national defense. Mm-hmm. What the debate is about is what is an effective national defense. Is it an effective national defense to go proactively go overseas and fight a war there in something that might be a civil war, for example? Is that effective in protecting the rights of Americans? Because the job of the United States government is to protect the rights of Americans. The job of the Canadian government is to protect the rights of Canadians. Is it effective to do, in order to do that, to go over into another country and become involved there? That's a pragmatic question. And oftentimes the answer to that is no, it is not effective. It makes things worse to go over there. Occasionally, there might be exceptions in which it might work. And I think in that case, even a Ron Paul or a Rand Paul would agree on a very rare and exceptional basis that maybe sometimes you should have to do it. So there isn't really a contradiction between a libertarian approach based on protecting rights domestically and also protecting us from foreign threats as well.
And one historical fact that does, I guess, argue in your favor is that Teddy Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, who were so effective at deterring America's enemies, because, of course, Teddy Roosevelt had the big stick and he had the heroic tale of San Juan Hill, the legend behind him. And Ronald Reagan scared the Iranians the minute he got on the scene into giving up the hostages. Because they were so good at deterring, they ended up doing very little militarily and not having to do much. Reagan invaded Grenada and Roosevelt fooled around in Nicaragua, and that was basically it. So they accomplished the most by doing the least.
Well, it's very difficult for me to say too many nice things about Teddy Roosevelt because he was a big progressive, and he was somebody who ran actually after he was president as a Republican, as a progressive Republican. He actually ran on his own, a new party. You know, it's called the Bull Moose Party because he became the nominee, but it was originally called the Progressive Party. Huh. He formed it, and it was called the Progressive Party. And so it was because of his splitting the Republican vote that Woodrow Wilson became president, and Woodrow Wilson was not up to very much good. I mean, he was bad on race and he was bad on war, and as a result, it was Teddy Roosevelt gave us Woodrow Wilson.
But he was a good deterrent. That's my only point. He was a good deterrent because of his war record. He was believed, and he didn't have to waste the army. That's all I'm saying.
And you're right. You wave Teddy Roosevelt in front of me, and then I start getting distracted, right? But you're right. A strong national defense can deter an awful lot of problems. That means you don't have to fight.
One stunning idea, fascinating idea in your work is that you are in favor of a non-monopolistic justice. In other words, I suppose one could say it's libertarianism applied to justice the same way it can be applied to the school system or the health system. But how would it work exactly?
I think that the services that we associate with the legal system can be provided competitively. We understand that police services, for example, can be provided competitively. We have more private police in this country than we have government police. Mm-hmm. It's also possible to do adjudicative services, court services, competitively. We have private adjudication. Almost everyone who signs a contract with a major company agrees to private arbitration, and private arbitration is less expensive, more effective. I myself have successfully received a very nice cash payout from T-Mobile when I had a dispute over my bill going into private arbitration. There's no way that I would have brought that suit in federal court, even as a lawyer, against T-Mobile. But private arbitration was inexpensive. In fact, T-Mobile ended up paying for the cost of the arbitration. And so, again, court services can be provided competitively as well. We cannot expect the government to provide court services efficiently any more than we can expect them to provide postal services efficiently. I've been in the legal system. I know how inefficient it is and how insensitive it is to the average citizen who needs to go into that system. And in my book, The Structure of Liberty, I explain how it's possible to have a polycentric legal order in which you basically subscribe to legal services the way you would subscribe to healthcare services.
And after all, it has been noted and measured and proven many times, America per capita is by far the most litigious society, the one with the most lawyers, and the one where the most money is spent on litigation.
Well, look, I'm a law professor. I train lawyers. And I'm going to say something that your audience may think is self-serving, but I believe in lawyers. If you get in trouble, the only thing that stands between you and a wrongful prosecution, I used to be a prosecutor, but the only thing that stands between you and a wrongful prosecution is a private defense lawyer or a public defender, but it's going to be a lawyer. It's going to be your lawyer, and you better have one, and you better hope that that lawyer is a good lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that's because in our system, every individual citizen has a right to his own counsel. In order to protect him either from the government or from private parties who have aggressed against them. And so for that reason, I think lawyers provide a very important role in protecting our liberty.
And after all, the system you argue for, in civil law at least, would definitely, obviously, cost less and have less litigation enacted and less lawyers being employed. I mean, the whole thing would shrink.
Well, one would hope. I mean, it's... a system where you have to compete and you have to charge and everything's not free. I mean, the things that are free are the most expensive things. You know, it's like just wait till healthcare is free and then you'll just see how expensive it gets, right? That is happening right now. I think the phrase is, if you think healthcare is expensive now, just wait till it's free. That's the expensive. That's the saying. So anyway, one would assume that one would hope that under competitive market conditions, the prices are reduced for legal services the way they tend to be reduced for all services that are subject to competition.
Therefore, when all is said and done, do you think that in your lifetime you will see a lot of these things come to pass, that you'll have an America more similar to what you're hoping for, or will it take longer?
Well, look, the reason to think about a polycentric legal order is not because I actually think that will happen anytime soon, but it's only that people who are against liberty always say to you something like this: if you got your way, then that would lead to no government this or no government that, and therefore that's an argument for why we shouldn't even take a single step in the direction of liberty. I think the reason why we think about things like the model of a polycentric legal order is not because we necessarily think it will happen, but only that we can respond and say, you know, if it did happen, it would actually be better than what we have now. So let's take a single step in direction of liberty, because we don't have to be worried about what 100 steps looks like, because 100 steps would even be better. And that's the reason why we have these, in some sense, thought experiments about those sorts of worlds. But to answer your question directly, yes, I do think that
America will be a freer place.
I think America will be a freer place in part because of what I've already mentioned. There is already an indigenous popular political movement to have a constitutional order, to reestablish our constitutional order. We are in somewhat of a post-constitutional regime in which the rules of the Constitution are not really followed by the government. And there is a political movement to try to restore the Constitution. And I'm hoping that that movement does succeed in my lifetime.
Well, Randy Barnett, we often end wishing our guests long life and good luck, so highly appropriate in your case.
Well, the nice thing about having kids is our time horizon are extended, so it only really needs to happen in our kids' lifetime. Wow, doesn't have to be our lifetime.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Bob.
Randy Barnett was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of The World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.